Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling groundbreaking.
Oh.
And that's just one word of many, not really to describe myself. No, it's not. It's all one word, babes. Groundbreaking.
Oh, it's hyphenated. It must be hyphenated.
I don't want it to be hyphenated. I want it to be all one word. Okay. Anyway, it's the only word I could really think to describe today's guests. And I use the word guests plural because we have not one, but five guests. And that in itself is groundbreaking.
Would you say they were a collective of guests, Rob?
Yes, I would say they were a collective of guests. And actually, there's many words I would use to describe them, such as like bold, active, brave, resourceful, fearless. Like, it's endless, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we are speaking to today's guests all the way from Belfast. And they are not only groundbreaking for being the most guests on Talk Art, but also because they recently collectively won the Turner Prize. And they were actually the first Northern Irish artists to win the Turner Prize, which in itself is a much needed thing because I feel like it's long overdue. And as you know full well from a recent episode we had on Talk Art with the Turner Prize judges, I think everyone will know what I thought about the whole situation with the critics and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm just very proud and very excited to be welcoming to Talk Art
Array Collective.
Hello. We should really do a name check, I think, of each guest.
So there are 11 members of Array Collective, but today we have Clodagh Lavelle. Hi, Clodagh.
Hello, hello. Absolutely buzzing to be here on Talk Art.
We've got Jane Butler. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi. Thomas Wells. You all right, Thomas?
Yeah, I'm not bad. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Good. Sheila Branagh Cashel. How are you, Sheila?
Hello.
Nice to see you. And Emma, Emma Campbell. Hi, Emma.
Hey.
It's so good to see you guys. Yeah, I was saying before we come on, it's just like Celebrity Squares, the way we do this on Zoom, is that we're all on
I know, we should actually do a screenshot of it. It's really funny.
We'll do a screenshot. So are you all in Belfast right now?
Yeah, we are. In fact, we're not too far away from each other either, I think, kind of within a good kind of few streets. Oh, sorry, Emma's a bit further away.
I'm in Bangor.
Where are you?
Bangor.
It's Bangor. Okay.
Seaside.
Oh, nice. So there's 11 of you, mm-hmm. And there's also two babies and one toddler as part of Array Collective. But out of the 11 of you, you're saying you're all quite close to each other. You are actually friends, and you do all socialise together.
Yeah, I mean, even this weekend.
No, we generally do, and not just in the way that the Spice Girls did. Like, we generally are all friends, and we do all generally all work together. And I think it's just really a testament to kind of how Belfast works, yeah. And how, like, we generally have all just kind of met through common. Like, me and Sheila went to art college together back in 2006, and then kind of she was the one who kind of got me over. As you can tell by my accent, I'm not from Belfast, but she's the one who kind of got me over here, which has been great.
I think that's one of the reasons we work so well. Like, we started as friends, that turned into a collective rather than the other way around. So it wasn't like, let's be a collective. It was kind of like we were just doing things naturally together, and we like each other. We hang out together. I think that's why we gel so well. There's no real like inside gossip, like we hate each other.
Do you think 11 is a finite number? Is there people that are like, I want to be part of the Array, and we're like, no, the shutters are down?
I think it kind of became a finite number when we did the Jarwood show.
Yeah.
Because originally it was the studio members, of which there were sort of 6/7. And then when we got invited to do the Jarwood show, we decided, well, actually, we've been working quite closely with these other people as well. It doesn't feel right to keep it just the studio members. So that was how this sort of it came to 11. And then now it's a bit finite because it's 11 people's hard enough to organise. That's the only reason why it wouldn't extend, because there are loads of other people who work. There is loads of other people who we work quite closely with, but I think we have to cut it off at some point, you know.
And how do you all connect with each other? Is this like a WhatsApp group? Are you on an email chain?
Slack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The worst thing ever. Yeah. And then, you know, and we have loads of other crossovers. Like there's a couple in the group. There's Tom and Sinead live together. Claude and Grace live together. Me and Sinead are sisters. You know, there's like loads of people work together in other capacities. So we're all seeing each other constantly. So there's kind of like, it goes through the grapevine as well.
Right.
As
right. So when you talked about the studios, so you're all based in the same studio, because outside of the collective, you are all individual artists making your own work. And you do also have jobs to fund your individual art practices as well as the collective. But did you all meet then, because this studio is in the middle of Belfast, did you all kind of connect via that studio as well?
We all kind of knew each other already, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. Belfast is so small.
Probably late night art is a big component of it, where we would have all got together. There's a lot of, our friends would be in openings and everything on late night art in Belfast, and we'd all hang out there. But like, few of us work together, some of us were friends. It's really hard for some of us to figure out when we first met, because we've been around each other for a long time, you know?
Yeah.
I think.
Definitely. I was trying to figure this out. I was like, who do I know the longest? But I feel like I can't even remember half of the encounters, the first ones. Like, I know Sheila, Laura, you know, for so, so long. I'm the longest member of Array. The longest person
we are.
There.
The longest.
I'm actually quite long, but long, you know. But like, yeah, I think like probably the most recent is Tom, was maybe like 3 or 4 years. But like, yeah, a long, long time. A lot of us go back.
I was going to say, there was something in the past kind of few years that happened that we just kind of ended up rallying together, and I think kind of really solidified our relationship. And that was the idea of going on rallies and kind of making work in a more kind of political way that kind of really cemented our friendships, I think, and as artists as well.
And actually the physical location of your studio, I know it's you're actually going to have to move. I read somewhere that because of like gentrification and also rising rents in Belfast, which is just a really sad thing for art. And obviously that's happening across the UK. Can you speak a bit about the importance of the location, actually where you were located or currently are but might have to move from, and how important that was to the kinds of things you ended up doing?
Yeah, I guess the city centre is important for our location because of the rallies we would attend, and if someone had to drop in and pick up a banner or a flag or whatnot and bring it along. So yeah, it's pretty important space.
Yeah, because, well, for people listening, you together create collaborative actions in response to socio-political effects in the north of Ireland. And also, we've said Northern Ireland, but you guys also refer to it as a north of Ireland, which I kind of picked up recently. What is that what we should be saying, or is that what you guys are saying?
It's a place with many names. like the city of Derry, for example, you can call it Derry or Londonderry. You know, it's officially Derry/Londonderry because it's so contentious what you call it, and it sort of gives away where your political allegiances lie depending on how you say it. So yeah, there are many here who would say that it's the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland, that Northern Ireland doesn't actually exist.
Yeah. or shouldn't exist. Well, no.
So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and making work based in the north of Ireland, it's obviously with the history, it's the troubles, it's what people are still reeling from and still dealing with on a daily basis that you guys are affected by. And within the collective, there are both Catholic and Protestant members, which in a contemporary setting is completely fine. But in a historical setting, this is kind of groundbreaking for you guys to be making this work together in this way.
Yeah, I think though when we like, because the conversation around kind of art in the north of Ireland is so kind of divided into these kind of tropes of kind of Catholic, Protestant, Union, Loyalist, there is, like, we kind of very much decided that we didn't want to kind of go down that route. We want to talk very much about, like, this new tertiary, more progressive kind of language that's coming out of politics in the north of Ireland. You know, those, the kind of issues that we work with and kind of are issues that affect both communities and both, like, greatly, and like they and there's a lot of kind of trauma that, like, kind of those have embedded into both communities and all communities. So I think that, like, kind of there is, and I'm saying this as also a blow-in, but also as, like, who have someone who has kind of Irish heritage and Irish kind of background, and I'd be the diaspora that moved out from the kind of generations that kind of moved out of Ireland in the 70s, like so many kind of did.
And you're called the blow-in. I love that.
A blow-in. Yeah. Okay. Just come for the Turner Prize.
It's not unusual here for Catholics and Protestants to be friends and work together in loads of different ways, you know, and culture with a small C is where that happens here. You know, like, despite the sort of politicians trying to keep it a divided society by having non-integrated education and sort of, distinct areas in Belfast where only certain communities can live. Like, you know, the music scene's always been very mixed. The art scene's always been very mixed like that. To us, it's not a big deal that we're a mixed group at all, you know, but it's funny how it's been picked up in the press as this, like, wow, Catholics and Protestants who aren't fighting with each other, whereas, yeah.
And also, like, my son is, like, the third generation of someone who is from mixed background, you know. That's been happening for a while now, so there's a few wee halfers in array as well. and I think outside of Northern Ireland, people don't realize that that happens, or don't realize that it is more normal now. And because people only see the headlines, they only see this very like chalk outline version of Northern Irish people or people in the north of Ireland, you know.
And actually, that's something that really annoyed me, I think, with some of the criticism for the Turner Prize this time, was that I just felt like there was huge ignorance from many writers and people who just sort of glossed over, or not glossed over, but there was a kind of, like, I don't know, just, they weren't very well informed and they didn't seem to want to educate themselves either. So they just kind of have these assumptions which they thought were correct, but they never really checked were correct. And just the way they were writing was quite biased a lot of the time, I thought. And, you know, it's been 100 years. It was the 5th of December 2021 that marks exactly 100 years of the Anglo-Irish Agreement. And it's a long time in history, you know, 100 years, if you actually think about it. And there's been all these things that have changed every decade. But I just feel like there's very little knowledge within the kind of art media in particular, which is located often out of London. And what was your like personal feelings to some of the writing or the way that things just kind of got almost like stereotypically kind of written about?
And there was definitely a sense of pissing off the right people by and large. But there were a few papers that we were a bit surprised or annoyed about, but mostly we were expecting it, I think.
I think the kind of that real sense of it being of kind of focusing on like kind of the pub element as being a real like kind of stereotype of Irish culture was kind of a bit like, oh, come on, like you're better than this. Or like you kind of, can you not just kind of go beyond the kind of surface cracks of kind of what it means to come to Ireland and be here? And I think that was, and I think the kind of the writers, so kind of who were connected to us, Kira Hickey and Jane Morrow, who wrote an amazing piece for The Elephant.
Yeah,
who
I love
that. About the labour. It was just like, my God, broke like to tears reading that.
Yeah, like there didn't feel like there was any real critical engagement with it whatsoever from the press. And in a way, like, you know, we're all our own worst critics. So it was like, God, I can think of a few things you could have said. But, you know, we all like criticise our own artworks all the time. And, you know, I think for us, being nominated was such a big deal, yeah. And some of us were quite nervous about the reaction and certainly nervous about how the show would be received. And then sort of the journalism was just so lazy. Yeah. It's like, you're not even trying to take us down almost. That's kind of how I felt about it. So it just felt it didn't bother me in the slightest because, you know, they hadn't even, when the nominations first came out and there was the sort of pretend hoo-ha about whole collectives, you know, what's the end of the individual artist? It's like, they haven't even looked at our website that says we're all also individual artists. You know, it was quite lazy journalism, really, is all I thought from it. So, yeah.
I think I said on the night that it just felt like the Turner Prize just gets a kick in every year, whoever's nominated. It's just a given that the press go for it. So I wasn't shocked or surprised or anything. And I thought, this isn't for the critics, this is for the people. And so many people saw that exhibition because it was at Coventry this year at the Herbert. Coventry was a city of culture for 2021. And so many people went through them doors and saw the exhibition. And so many people were drawn to your work. And what we saw, for the people that didn't know, for the Turner Prize this year, is you created, Thomas mentioned a pub, but I think the term is Shabeen.
Yeah, Shabeen.
Shabeen.
Yeah.
Shabeen.
And you could sit in this, it was like an installation. You could sit in there and you would rest and you would have a moment of pause and a moment of reflection. And on the screen, it was an immersive experience like a pub, and there was like ashtrays and there was paraphernalia around that was advertising women's rights and LGBT issues and charities. And then there was a film playing, which was called The Druid's Ball. And all you guys had got up and told stories and sung songs and wore costumes. And it was so moving and celebratory. And as an audience member coming in that wouldn't know anything about any of these collectives who were in the Turner Prize nominee list, but not anything about, you know, the north of Ireland for what was actually going on, it was such an incredible experience, which is why you were rightly winners. But what did you feel like from the reactions of the public? So forget all the critics that get paid for it, but the people that are there out of pleasure, what was the response like, Clodagh?
Response from people, like, as I do the social media, so like, see, the night we were nominated, it was like so overwhelming, just the amount of people. It felt more like a football match, like, so, you know, than an art thing. It was just like, wah! It was like Belfast has won something, or Belfast is up for something massive. And then the night that we did win, like, the response is just, I think that's one of the really, really lovely, beautiful things about this, is the way it's been received here, and people are so proud, and it kind of feels like, I don't know, you'd even be in a taxi and they'd be like, oh, you're one of those ones that won the art thing, and be like, we would never win anything here. Do you know, I don't know, it was a real, so little comments like that, or people like leaving a Bridget's Cross in the Shebeen for us, or comments on Instagram, and yeah, response has been so lovely. And one of the really, like, with all the messages on Instagram and stuff the night that we won, was about the babies being on stage. Laura, yes. Sheila and Emma having their kids on stage. Like, that was a real, like, I remember saying, God, that is the most popular comment. Do you know? But yeah, the response has been so, so lovely. It means a lot.
I've got to say as well that the staff at the Herbert, and especially the invigilation staff, like the one at Richard O'Leary, who was one of the performers who was in the film, The Druid's Ball, went over like on his own without us to go and see the work, and he was instantly recognised by the invigilate, who, like, we'd got to know really well, and like they'd come out drinking with us during the install, and it was brilliant. But they really just took care of that work. And Alice, the curator, who kind of worked with us, was kind of like, they were, if anything was kind of moved or disrupted, they just knew every little bit of that show, and they were amazing. The Herbert staff are incredible. Absolutely big shout out to them.
And when we were over for the D install as well, whenever we were taking it down, the staff like kept coming in, and they were so sad to see it go. It was like a part of them was going as well, so they had made a connection with it. And yeah, they just kept, they were just so sad to see it go. Too.
Yeah. Well, Richard O'Leary, who you just mentioned, is a gay rights campaigner. And actually for me, that was one of the most powerful moments of the film, because he told a story about fairies, and, you know, I'm a fairy, Rob's a fairy, so it's something that I really connected to. But he tells this story about fairies during the Troubles. And again, like we're talking about how Protestants and Catholics are friends, then it was not the case. And being queer crossed boundaries, broke down walls. And he told this incredible story, and he's a massive ally for you guys. And how did Richard come into your kind of orbit, and how did you guys collaborate with him? And he's a long-running collaborator, right?
Yeah, so Richard, Sinead Branagh-Cashel, so Sheila's sister, kind of got me in touch with kind of Richard, because he was running a project here called, he was digitalizing the LGBTQ archive. So is kind of, so he's been working on digitalizing kind of archive work from kind of the late 80s to the early 90s. And so I kind of got to know him kind of through that kind of project, where he would do kind of online talks about kind of his life. But all of his stories. So Richard O'Leary is a self-proclaimed fairy from Cork. That's how he identifies. But came up to study at Queen's in the 70s. and kind of stayed and lived with his partner, who Russell's completely was right. Like it was difficult not only to be a Protestant and a Catholic, but also be in a same-sex relationship with a Protestant was just an extra layer of kind of abuse that this couple kind of got. So Richard tells these amazing stories about what it was like to not only face religious adversity, but also sexual orientation discrimination kind of in Ireland at the time. Yeah, I don't want to talk any more about kind of Richard's stories, because I think I want kind of the audience to go and find him and go and listen to the stories and
oh yeah,
listen to the journey that Richard has gone on.
Yeah,
but he is a collaborator, and he will continue to work with him. I think for as long as we keep going.
Oh, you've got it. He's an incredible storyteller. I mean, just so captivating. He tells this story about, you know, his life and moments that happened. Yeah. It's incredible. So yes, everyone should go and check out Richard O'Leary. So Jane, so when you're creating a community and solidarity through your art, how do you choose what to align yourselves with as a collective? How do you decide what is the protest that you guys are going to get involved with?
I don't think we ever made the decision like this is what we're going to align ourselves with. These are issues that we were feeling quite personally affected by anyway, so it just felt quite natural to be part of them. And it's probably important to mention that, you know, we weren't working for these groups. We were part of them, and they didn't ask us to come in. You know, we were already on the street being colourful, being loud. So it just felt quite natural to kind of fall into that we were already falling in, like we were already there anyway. So in terms of that, like obviously the kind of issues that we've been dealing with, looking at like mental health, the Language Act, gentrification, as you mentioned, social housing, LGBTQ, and abortion rights, women's bodily autonomy. So, I mean, these are all things we're personally affected by. So, like, I mean, it was never a decision to like go for particular ones. And because the political climate at the time in Belfast was quite like, yeah, it was disrupted. So, I mean, it just felt natural to be part of these.
Absolutely. But you, the way you approach it is with such humour and play, and there are performances and there are costumes, and it's kind of like comedy has the ability to kind of permeate quicker than anger or shouting. It's like you say something funny, you can get a message across quicker. Why is humor so important to the collective, Clodagh?
Well, I always take this question because I'm the funniest, though. Just to
you're the longest, you're the 12 foot, so
I'm hilarious and 12 foot tall. Well, I think it's like a few things. I suppose, like, we are friends, so we share, I suppose, a sense of humour. We find the same kind of things funny, a sense of the absurd as well, I think. And I think we did an interview recently, and Tom brought up that, like, you know, if it was so serious all the time, like, because some of the issues, all the issues we deal with are so kind of hardcore, and they can be quite upsetting and sad, that, like, it could be so depressing, and we might, you know, it'd be a hard thing to do all the time. But if we're kind of like dealing with it with a bit of humor, or it's given us a way to look at it that's like not wholly depressive, but we still want to do it. But yeah, I think we also just get on a lot and have a laugh together, and I think that's quite important.
Yeah, or have a gig, which is the Belfast equivalent of LOL. Yeah.
I said in one video, I said, have a gig, GEG, which is the Belfast equivalent of LOL. Have a laugh. So instead of like,
yeah, have a laugh. LOL, have a laugh.
Nobody questioned it.
I also really think that humour can be a method of survival as well. So if you have trauma, or you have, you know, political situations happening that are stopping you living your life the way you want to, humor can like free you up and help build solidarity actually between your friends, and but also just give you a sense of hope, because without you know, hope and laughter, then what is life? You know, I love this idea as well, which is obviously a fact, that there's this kind of unresolved trauma from the conflict that nobody talks about. And once things seem to be better or, you know, or maybe have been resolved a bit further, then suddenly everyone thinks everyone's fine. But actually there's this kind of long-term present day trauma that people suffer. And there's really high suicide rates, and there's, you know, people being very depressed and even not being able to communicate to each other because they spent decades not talking about their feelings because they had to, you know, fight for survival in a way. Can you speak a bit about humor in relation to trauma as well? And also this whole reality of trauma.
Emma, do you want to answer that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think as a place, we're definitely known for a certain kind of dark and dry gallows humour. And certainly, you know, like, and the others will probably agree, because most of us have lived, even the ones from the north of Ireland have all lived somewhere else at some point. And sometimes you'll say something that will be way over the line when you're in a different context. But it would have been fine in Belfast. So, I 100% think it's a coping strategy for sure. And it's a way of saying things. But I think with humor, you're building a connection with somebody straight off the bat. And then people have a little think afterwards about what was actually said, even though you mightn't have been straightforward with the joke. Yes. And there is a certain thing in Belfast, like if you're not taking the piss out of somebody, it means you don't like them. So, I mean, I'm not sure how healthy that is, but it's definitely what we do. So, or yourself as well, you know, there's a lot of self-deprecating humor as well. I think, like, Sheila's quite good with some of the humor stuff as well, I think.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's definitely like something that's very within the culture here, is to be just constantly making fun almost. And like, I think there's a real, I don't know, I kind of describe it as like a bipolarness to the whole city, where it's either really hyper and really up or completely down and not much in between, you know. And that's something we wanted to try and express about, like, what this place means to us is very different to how it's portrayed, you know. And it's normally portrayed as just bleak and just the troubles, and it's like there's this whole richness to it, which is why we love the place. Like, even though it's sometimes the most awful place, you know, it's also amazing and really vibrant, and that's because it's this real high and low. And definitely, you know, even like my parents would talk about, sometimes they would worry because the stories that are told about the troubles are always like funny and a laugh, and it sort of almost paints this picture as if actually that was great crack, you know, because they're covering up for how awful it was and how afraid they all were constantly. And it's this, you know, it's a very like, yeah, a very Irish thing as well. It's not just the north, definitely.
I guess that's like our nan and granddad say, like, they had a lovely time in the war.
Yeah.
It's just that thing, and you're like, it's that sort of, it is definitely that. But Sheila, but through like the activist approach that you guys have towards art, have you actually felt a change or witnessed a change that your art practice has made towards law changes or towards the way that people are represented and seen?
It's sort of, yeah, I mean, in some ways it feels like a lot's changed here recently, but I wouldn't ever put that down to our art. You know, I feel like we were a part of these movements, but those changes were kind of happening anyway. And then, you know, I'll let Emma talk a bit more about that through the work with the Lands for Choice. But one thing that I sort of felt that I wasn't expecting to feel about the Turner Prize was that, you know, I think when we first got asked to do the Jarrowood and the Turner, we weren't quite sure how our activism would fit into a gallery, and sort of even had slight ethical questions around, should it, you know, it doesn't suddenly feel like we're sort of selling out in a way, or it's the wrong context for it. But actually, because the Turner was so, so high profile, and because of how amazingly it's been accepted in the North, it almost feels like that's been a piece of activism in itself. Like, a lot of people getting in contact to congratulate us who would not have the same views as us at all, you know. Like, the fact that you're sitting around a dinner table and you have to explain to your uncle what, you know, that you make work about abortions, you know, that you just wouldn't have even said that word 5 years ago at all. So it's almost validated that. So then that's something that really took me by surprise. I didn't think that was going to happen. And yeah, the fact that you're the Lord Mayor had us on an open bus going through Belfast, and, you know, that, like,
heroes.
These are things that aren't spoken about, you know, that suddenly, because of the prestige of the prize. Basically, it sort of catapulted it into now that's the mainstream. Now this way of thinking is the mainstream. We're not the weirdos on the side.
That's fantastic.
But I'll let Emma talk about Alliance for Choice and sort of how they felt about the artwork that we were helping out with.
Yes, please, Emma. Who are the Lands for Choice?
Alliance for Choice is the organisation I'm involved with that campaign on abortion rights. And I got involved with them through my art, essentially. So I was doing a piece about women's journeys over to England, because that was the main way people were able to access it until the law changed. But I think, you know, there's a writer called Lucy Lepard, and she talks about how, of course, art activism isn't the way that you can change things on its own, but then nothing is. Nothing on its own changes culture, changes society, changes laws. It has to be a little bit of everything. And the abortion rights movement in the whole island of Ireland really purposefully had a whole art strand. Like we organized a creative and direct action group as a central part of organizing the movement, because it is so important. And I think, you know, culture quite often is pushing things before politics gets there. You know, it's catching up quite a lot of the time. And so I think we can be powerful. So sometimes, like when we're on the street in rallies, we're bringing humor with slogans or kind of, I guess, one-liner costumes or whatever. But other bits of the art that we all do individually and as a collective might be a bit more nuanced and subtle, and delve a bit more into the lived experience of things where politicians might not necessarily or activists might not necessarily get to. So I think there's a whole lot of ways that art can facilitate that change or help tell human stories, because that's really what art is about, you know, about telling all these human stories that people can connect to.
I think I actually really felt that this year's Turner Prize, you know, last year's Turner Prize, was really questioning what art was and the kind of strategies that you can put into place within art that can actually, you know, bring up really traumatic, you know, difficult topics that no one really wants to talk about in a really unusual way. And, you know, across the board, or I think all the different collectives that were selected were doing things really in such a clever way, and I think highly intelligent way, in order to sort of bring about change. And there was this idea as well of like social work, or all these ideas, you know, that is art being reduced to social work. But actually, I think it completely missed the point, because it was like art has always been about social change, and art has always been about sharing people's voices from across the world and making us all understand each other more and hopefully building bridges, if anything. So I can you speak a bit about art? You know, what is art? Or like, you know, how do you collaborate to create art, you know, as a collective?
Yeah, surely, because there must be a dominant voice. I mean, you guys must have these regular meetings. But what Rob's saying, how do you decide, and how did you decide on the installation for the Turner Prize?
I think rather than kind of talk about kind of what is art, I think what something that kind of is kind of like, what is an artist? And I think that kind of like that is something that, you know, I think none of us have come from like a background that we ever expected to ever be in this position or be like a full-time artist and have to and have our entire kind of income generation kind of be from kind of one thing. And I think kind of meeting all the other collectives and everyone who is involved in all those collectives, how much we are part of other infrastructures. And so like, and, you know, especially like Gentle Radical and Project Artworks, and I'm not discounting Boss or Cooking Sections either with this, but we're all part, like we're all interconnected within these systems of care and systems of well-being, just trying to kind of make everything just a little bit better. So I think kind of like for me, what like the idea of what an artist is actually kind of radically kind of changed over the past kind of 10 years after, like, you know, graduated from art college, when you were kind of told, you know, if you weren't going to sell paintings, then you wouldn't be an artist anymore. I think kind of it being incredibly individual and being part of a community is kind of what an artist is about. Therefore, art is about that. I don't know.
No, I love that. I love that response. But then, so then with the success of Array Collective, and you are individual artists, is your individual art starting to struggle against the success of the collective? How do you dedicate yourselves, your own individual times, and as much is being put on a collective array right now?
I feel like a lot of us had reached a point where we were almost semi-retired with our
Really?
And I don't mean that as in, like, I think to be a career artist, to sort of make your full income from being an artist is just impossible, like, especially in Northern Ireland. Like, it's like, so we all have full-time or part-time jobs, and I think we're all still have our own practice, which is as much for ourselves because we need to make art and we have ideas to make art, than an art career. If you sort of chase that forever, you can, end up not making anything by spending so much time trying to make a career out of it. I actually made more art when I stopped doing application forms, you know, and I think it is an interesting one because now this has happened with Array, but, you know, two of us have just had babies. We all have full-time jobs. It's like the time to make art is already squeezed.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, I don't think all 11 of us are going to be able to give up our jobs and suddenly make a fortune out of art, even though this has happened to us. I don't know. I think we're quite grinded in that way. Yeah.
Well, I love the fact that you, with the Turner Prize is obviously a winning prize for £25,000. But you guys, when you got nominated, none of you would speculate if you did win what you'd spend the money on because you didn't want to jinx it. But then on the night when you did win it, I think there's a headline saying we have to have a meeting. Where has the prize money gone from winning something like the Turner Prize? What does that go towards now?
We have been thinking about that. Yeah, I think at the ceremony we did mention, you know, investing it back into a building. As you know, we need to be out of our building in 18 months. And just thinking about securing a long-term premises where we can kind of be, it can be sustainable and self-sufficient at the same time without relying heavily on kind of public funding would be ideal. But yeah, we'll see what happens. I'm sure another meeting will need to happen for that to come to a conclusion.
But you have a collective bank account that money's just sat in now at the minute that you all, okay, cool. It's not like it's been split up with everyone and you're all just sort of right in separate ISAs.
Holding on to it. So
I've had some work done.
Resting in my account.
Stretched you out even longer.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
And actually, Sheila, you were talking about the kind of specific context of the location where you all are in relation to the way that art is supported. Mm. And I read in the Kiara and Jane article that was in Elephant magazine, like the last point was kind of this idea that there needs to be change in the way that there is funding for arts, specifically in the north of Ireland. Can you speak a bit about that specific context? Because I think that's one of the key things about why Array Collective was so needed, so important, why it was birthed in a way, because of all of those situations which are very unique in a way to your location.
Yeah, I think we'll sort of like, we already got the least funding for art in the UK, know, compared to the other parts of the UK, we get the least. But also then the way that's divided up here is just so sectarian. Basically it gets taken for things that progress the politics of the two governing bodies, you know, so it becomes more difficult to get money for art that doesn't look at those things. And then there's no commercial art scene here to speak of. There is like a slight one, but not compared to other places. So there's not, you know, so public funding really is a big way for artists to be supported here, which is why a lot of people leave. Get, you know, so many talented artists just have to give up at a certain point because it's impossible. And also just, you know, it is a small place. We are on an island. So like, we're used to doing exhibitions that 10 people might come and see. Two of them are parents. And, you know, like, there's a, yeah, it's hard to be seen here, I think, you know, on a international platform.
What does keep you going then? What is the driving force that makes you guys continue if it does feel so hard at times?
I think, well, like, for me personally, it's just making art. Like, I enjoy making it. It's something that helps me do, and I have constant ideas. And I think it would be very easy to get quite bitter and not make anything because you're so fed up with the art system. And yeah, I just think you could, you can try and change it. And I think that's definitely a positive thing to do, but you also have to keep some for yourself. And us as a collective, like, we, you know, we weren't seeing that as an art practice, as a careerist thing at all. You know, that's why we're so surprised we're in this position, because we were really doing it for the causes and for ourselves. And because we were enjoying making it, there was no strategy in it, you know, so that's, I think we'll continue to do that, you know. Yeah.
And genuinely, like, Belfast is such a supportive place to make artwork in. Like, you know, and I know it sounds a bit like working class hero, but like, there's no, you know, there might not be provision, there might not be studios, but like, the community here is amazing. And, you know, for a lot of years, it worked on this kind of tit for tat kind of economy where like someone would help someone out and some for another show, and then that was the economy that it was kind of based on. And it is really good crack to make work here, like, and I think that's what keeps us, well, of course, that's what keeps me going anyway. That's why I stay.
Well, and at these gatherings and these performances, there are a lot of symbols that come into play. But Emma, there's a symbol which is I kind of really associate with you guys, and I'd never come across her before, and it's Sheila Nagig. Yeah. And this is a symbol that is from folklore. And I'd love you to talk about Sheila the Geek, because now I see her in places and it just makes me think of a ray. But also, to further that question, is that we're living in a culture for social media and lots of like photos being taken. And this is an image that is, you know, for some people, for the social media police, might be like upset with. I mean, how do you keep that without being shadow banned on Instagram? How do you keep that image alive? But yeah, let's talk about Sheila Nagig for us, please.
So Sheila Nagig is a figure that used to be found throughout Celtic Europe. So there were a lot in Wales, northern France, and kind of southern England as well. But the majority of the remaining Sheila Nagigs are in Ireland, and normally over gathering buildings or gathering places, and it would have been this little figure's got two hands holding wide open this giant vulva, and a lot of them were destroyed with the advent of Christianity, but they kept them in the Irish version of when they used the rooms for Christianity, and a lot of, I guess, feminists would use it to reclaim a certain. Yeah, it's a bit of a reclamation, I suppose, for us. And one of the most fun rallies that we had was when there was the parade of all the different, was there maybe 8 or 10 Sheilas that had little messages coming out of the revolver, like "feck off" or "Era says relax" or
disco ball.
And there's also Sean the Gigs as well. Yeah.
Sean, there's a Sean the Gig.
Yeah.
So what's he pulling apart?
I don't think he's
pulling. We're not sure. We have to go visit that one.
Yeah, like.
right.
Like, you know, some of us have been censored before, not even just on social media, but that's my dog. Censored on the, you know, walls of Belfast, street art or whatever. But I guess with the Ray, we're always trying to push a few buttons, I think, as well. Right, I would say. Right.
And actually, the Ira says relax, which is a paraphrase of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, like that hit single from the 80s. Like, I think that was even mentioned. So can you speak a bit about that kind of wordplay and how important that is like within your work? Because I feel like that's a kind of layer within it all, like this kind of use of language, the kind of way that you can evolve a well-known phrase to be something else.
Yeah, that was actually a friend of mine, Kira Green, who came up with that one. She's from here, but lives in Brighton. And I had said to her, oh, we're going to make these Sheila in the gigs. And she was like, oh, you should make t-shirts saying that, you know, because part of the thing was to do with like ancient Ireland. Says relax, you know, like ancient Irish was fine with this. And that was on one of the abortion rallies, you know, so it's kind of this idea of like chill out. And then when we were running around with the placards, we were shouting, we may be made of stone, but our wombs are still our own. Yes. Was our like slogan for that. So it's kind of, yeah, and like we were wondering again with the Turner exhibition, like how much of it, of the in jokes would translate, you know, and would some of it just go over people's heads, because a lot of it can be quite colloquial or about, you know, very specifically Belfast-based things, you know. So it was nice to see that the whole exhibition was still well-received, even though there was all those layers in it, you know.
I think it's nice as well that that kind of shows this overlap between the feminist stuff that we do work about and the queer stuff. And quite often those things overlap, you know. It's not like they're two separate circles or... You know, it's more like a Venn diagram, especially for people in the collective as well. So I think that phrase is nice because it illustrates that quite well, I think, too.
I love the slogan, stop ruining everything, as well, which you have on a big pink banner. I think that's lovely. What is the main, right now, what are you working towards? What is the protest that's happening in the north of Ireland for you guys that you're kind of really championing?
I don't know if it's that we're championing again, because I wouldn't say that we championed any, but we're kind of part of the wider discussion. And I think at the moment it's very much talking about, because of what the Turner has highlighted in Northern Ireland about lack of provision, the conversation has now turned to lack of provision and lack of money and financing of arts here. And in fact, a boss of mine turned around and said, well, she was invited after we won to go and do an interview on BBC Radio Ulster, and and she doesn't really do many interviews, but she was like, it's the first time she could have a proper conversation about money on like with a national broadcaster. And it was kind of like something had shifted, and I think that was really important. And like, you know, and Emma and a few others have been involved in kind of all party groups to talk about on this matter. So now politicians are sitting down and politicians are listening, and hopefully something will change.
I actually really think as well that, like, I never understood why governments generally, like all over the world, often don't realise the power of their culture and the power of their citizens who are able to make art that can travel around the world, and it would end up being an amazing advert for their country.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and also would help educate people about their country, which is, in a way, it's not your job to educate necessarily, but, you know, we should all be educating ourselves, and that's our individual responsibility. But I do think even, you know, with Array Collective winning the Turner Prize, even myself, like, I've learned way more about Ireland than I knew before. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like you've allowed me to access something that I grew up in the 1980s listening to on the news, which was often about bombings, about kind of almost like terrorism, and kind of the language around it, even like this idea of sectarian, like even that word, like it's a word I really remember from being a child and never quite understood what these words meant. And I felt like all the news broadcasts often had these very large words, which is in a way is what we've been trying to break down with Talk Art, trying to like make people understand art is theirs, and it's not just about big words. Is that something I don't know, but you know, do you think it will change, like within Ireland, this idea of supporting the arts more, or with education as well? I don't know.
I mean, it's early days, I suppose, to say, like, you know what, we're used to being given a lot of false promises, you know, having meetings with different groups and, you know, being made promises that things will change and then they don't. But, you know, we don't want to be too pessimistic. But I think... yeah, certainly, like what you're saying about how you feel that you sort of received an education about here, I think that has been really important to us, you know, because it does always feel like we're ignored, you know, and, you know, because a lot of us have lived away or we're from other places, we've all had those conversations where you just realise how little people understand about what's going on here is. And I just really remember, like, I was over for the last Documenta, And that was around the time that, wasn't it, Theresa May's election, where the DUP then suddenly were these kingmakers. And I just was, you know, at this sort of art party with all these, you know, Euro art people. And they were like, who are the DUP? They're dreadful. I've just Googled them. And, you know, you're sitting there going, we've been screaming about these guys for years and no one has listened. And now all of a sudden that they affect you, it's suddenly that you can't believe that these, you know, people exist. And, you know, the same with Brexit. It was like the whole lead up to that vote, Northern Ireland was not mentioned, and we were just over here screaming, waving our arms, like going, you guys, this is going to be a disaster. And that's what's happened. You know, it's the whole thing is a mess because of Northern Ireland, you know. So it's, I think it was a very timely thing for us to do this in this year and the year of the centenary. It felt like people were ready to listen, I think, partially because it was starting to affect them and not just us, you know.
Right. And actually, there was a wordplay that you used in one of your, slogans, I guess, within the work that was about sausages, which had to do with Brexit and the idea, like, would the sausages make it to Ireland or not?
Yeah.
I loved that one.
And I mean, that way, like, the politicians here kind of write most of our jokes for us. It's so ridiculous. And there's like, yeah.
I guess there's a massive drive then to like, you've been at the Herbert and you're in the Jerwood show. It's like you have this drive to show your work outside of Northern Ireland, because that feels like it then has more of an impact on the people at home.
Yeah, and that took us by surprise. I think that's, you know, yeah, not something we necessarily expected. It's something we kind of set out to do, especially with the Jerwood show. We thought quite a lot about why it was important to do a show in London, and should we, and we thought yes, because that is where the seat of power is. That's exactly where we should be doing a show, you know. But yeah, the feedback now from this has been immense, and it's really like I said earlier, it's just opened up conversations here that wouldn't have happened otherwise. We could have done the same show here and it wouldn't have had the same impact.
That's incredible.
I think it will get a different response though when we bring it home, essentially, to here. I think it'll be responded to differently again, which will be pretty interesting.
So you're going to install it in Belfast? I mean,
hopefully, like, right. That is where the spiritual home of a shoot would be, or in Ireland, on the island of Ireland. So yeah, we'll see. But I mean, when that does happen, that will be again a different kind of audience and different reactions than over in England, for sure.
Yeah. But the work's all back with you guys now. That's all safely in the studios. No.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Still being packed up soon.
And I think shipments are taking a long time now. It's also the cost of shipments. So I think loads of things like go by truck or by sea instead of flying now, which is probably better for the environment anyway. But it means that everything's taking like 12 weeks instead of 1 week.
Yeah.
And yeah, but we have no choice. Like all of us in the art world, it's something we're all encountering. Like, you know, shipments are about 8 times more expensive than they used to be. It's just totally wild. You know, something that I was really inspired by with Array Collective is your resourcefulness, but also this kind of spontaneity, the way that you can react and respond and sort of take action in the moment when something political was happening. But you had this kind of artistic strategy, you know, to protest, to kind of raise attention to, you know, something that you all collectively believed in. Can you speak a bit about the importance of kind of the DIY aesthetic? And because there was one review where it said something like, you know, you would go to one of your kind of collective meetings, you know, outdoors where you're protesting, and the paint is still wet on the signs. Like, and I just loved that idea, because I think it's so important for people to realize that we all have power to make changes. And it might seem like your voice is a small voice, but, you know, coming together, you know, connecting to others, you can make a change.
Yeah, we had one of our WhatsApp groups for a while was called Arrays Assemble. And we would text in that WhatsApp group if something, you know, we needed to gather everybody really quickly.
Yeah.
And we all hoard a load of crap as well.
A lot of cardboard in our lives. But yeah, I think like it is, you know, that feeling. I feel like I've felt that feeling so many times before protest. Your hands almost shake and you're writing something on your placard. You have to be out in the street in like an hour, and you're like, I remember writing one you know, for abortion rights, and it was like, we didn't start the fire but we'll keep her lit. But my hand was shaking, I was so like, I need to get this out, I need to get on the street, you know, that kind of pure energy. And then you're out in the street and it's like smudging from the rain. There are ones that we do plan, like the Stop Ruining Everything. That's obviously printed and stuff like that. But there's a lot of kind of quick fire. Go, go, go. Let's go. I like that energy.
And as your artist, do you archive all these placards? Do they get stored somewhere? Is every kind of protest, every march, do you keep all the costumes safe and protected?
What did I say? In our damp building, and a lot of the sort of placards have been disseminated, and like Alliance for Choice have a load of the ones, so there'll be placards we've made just are at these rallies and we're not holding them anymore. You know, they kind of just went out there, and you know, and some of our favourites we've kind of held on to, and some then we put, you know, made the canopy that was above the shebeen with some of them as well. I suppose we might be a wee bit more precious about them now.
Yeah.
It's also true, isn't it? Damp really makes like paper or cardboard just melt, essentially. Yeah. It like basically disintegrates. And it's an invisible evil, because I recently discovered that myself. I had boxes of paper that literally have completely disintegrated and I've lost loads of stuff. But I had this funny joke as well, like, you know, like Thunderbirds Ago, where they would all sort of like come together, all like superheroes, when they all press the kind of red
Power Rangers.
They all kind of assemble. I love that idea of you guys all coming together
for the
greater good.
But it'd all be made out of cardboard boxes and it wouldn't quite fit together.
Yeah. Do you remember we had the heads? So we printed our own heads, big massive versions of our own heads. And if people couldn't come to a protest, you'd bring the heads with you. And I remember once thinking, like, what the hell? I was thinking, I put them on tennis rackets. So I had, like, Sheila, Sinead, the ones that couldn't be at the protest, I put them on tennis rackets. And then I was like, I'm not bringing six tennis rackets down to City Hall. So then I safety pinned them onto my jacket, and then you hold it open. So it's like the ones that can't be there are there visually. Yeah. Those heads are just...
heads ended up being, didn't they?
The two heads,
Because Sheila and
we're in the balaclavas.
Because they were busy birthing other humans, so we put their versions of those faces up in the shebeen. But the other thing I remembered is, like, it's not always like for a great cause. Like, one of the best crack exhibitions we had was late night art, when we were making fun of the guidance that we got about late night art from some like local arts and business organization that we thought was just like, they've clearly never been to our studios, if they're advising us to have a string quartet in the corner.
to increase visitor numbers.
Yeah, and Stephen DJed for the exhibition with his bag over his head the whole night. Just, we had little flags that said, this is art and this is not art. I mean, you know, that was silly, but it was so great as well.
You asked earlier about kind of what brought us all together, and we did another show that again wasn't for a protest, but we obviously all found our connective vibe when we were all doing our GCSEs and A-levels and highers. We did a show of our A-level artwork in the studio called Class Art, and the themes that ran through it were all very similar and very dark, even though we all grew up in different parts of the British Isles.
Very angsty. My favorite show we did.
I had a picture. I think I was told I was a like really good drawer when I was young. So it's like I thought I was a genius. But like my piece for that was like a picture of Johnny Depp with these like really boxy arms, and like hanging from fish gut. What, like, I unearthed it, and do you remember a picture of Johnny Depp? But I used to draw Johnny Depp, Gary Stringer from Reef. Anyone asked me to draw, I'd draw. But
oh my God, I remember Reef. They were amazing. You know, it's really funny, like, sitting here with you now, I know we're all virtual, but you get this real sense of camaraderie and like a kind of community in a sense. Like, how important is that for you? Because I often give the advice to younger artists to, instead of thinking about how is the art world going to accept me, it's like, forget about all that and just think about your peer group, about what's at your kitchen table, you know, what is within reach, because within all of us you have the power to sort of, you know, create art, and maybe you'll make a noise, maybe you won't, but it doesn't really matter. It's more about connecting to those within your reach, in a sense. How important is that for all of you? Does it give you power?
I was just to say, the other day I was giving an online talk and I was really nervous about it because it was more high profile than usual, and I remembered Sheila and Sinead were at my first ever artist talk in Belfast in the Black Box, and then Sinead was still at this one as well, and it just made me very emotional, and like, there's been that support for each other the whole way through.
Yeah.
we're very lucky in the sense that we are all friends. I mean, there is a certain amount of like care and security within the group as well, which is quite supportive and has kept us going, I think. Like we all check in with each other in a mental health way, you know, there's never any pressure on anyone. It's a very caring and comforting environment, which at times is unheard of in kind of the art world, in a sense. So I think we're very lucky in a sense that we've found our people to kind of be on this journey with, as cheesy as that sounds. But and yeah, it's just like looking at what you already have there, you know. Yeah, as you said, you don't need to look at what we're as surprised about this as anybody else. We just weren't expecting it, but you know, we're just very lucky to have each other, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so cute. And with the future of your studio in flux now, what are you planning? What is the collective sort of thinking about for that?
I suppose because the show's only just coming down, we're kind of still coming down to earth a bit with that. So we're discussing kind of how to move forward, and we would like to retain a studio building somewhere, ideally the city centre, but we may have to move out of the city centre and see what's the best way to secure that is, really. But we definitely all still want to work together, you know. We did talk a bit about like what actually do we need from a building, and maybe it's not 11 studios, you know. A lot of us work collectively, some of us, you know, use the studio more for storage than actually making work in. It's not a traditional studio setup, you know, and definitely I think at the heart of it would need to be workshop space and a project space, right, to invite other people in.
Nice.
You know, that's kind of a massive part of what we do. And I think, yeah, if we had something like a project space, it would program itself, because we have so many ideas for what we want to do. And so we all wear so many different hats. It's, you know, we all work with loads of other organizations and loads of other artists and other collective ways as well. So
yeah,
somewhere to host people would be great,
because
our building at the minute's awful.
Do you have plans to work with any of the other Turner nominees, any of the other collectors? Have you guys kind of swapped ideas and potential kind of collaborations coming up?
Yeah, I think, I mean, nothing confirmed, but like we definitely kind of worked or kind of spoke quite closely with Project Artworks. I think what they're doing in terms of access to kind of exhibitions, and so it's just incredible. And I think there's definitely plans, like we've been talking to Martin quite a lot, and I think there's definitely plans to do something with them in the future. It would be brilliant. But yeah, God, the invitation I think is open for all of them to come to Belfast and let's do something. That'd be great.
And Clodagh, what are you as Array working towards now? What is the next project, or
what is the next project, guys? Keeping afloat. And I suppose all of these a podcast, like we're getting a lot of these kind of opportunities, so we're kind of working through those. We have a few plans. I don't know how much I can say, but a few plans for shows this year, but I don't know what's set in stone or what I can say. But yeah, group exhibitions. There is the hope that maybe the Shebeen will be installed here, but that's yet to be kind of ironed out. But I think a lot of people looking across the waters had FOMO seeing it over there and they couldn't go, and especially because of COVID and all that. So that's probably one of our plans, to get that up and running here at some point. I'm missing something, haven't I, guys? What am I saying that we're not doing?
Well, if the curator of Documenta would like to give us 11 tickets to come and see Documenta this year, because it's all collective,
that
would be great.
Yes, please.
And Project Artworks is part of Documenta this year as well.
And Project Artworks are part of Documenta. Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Well, I'm sure they must. They're all listening to this.
Yes, absolutely.
Sorted.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the Shebeen then. Can you quickly just explain to everyone why you chose that as the kind of central structure that housed, you know, so many of your different ideas and kind of different estuaries, I guess, of what you've done? What why was it that? Why was that so significant?
It sort of organically came about, I suppose. Like, we had conversations about, you know, how are we going to respond to this invitation? And the centenary came up as a theme because that was the year that was in it. And yeah, it was sort of, how do we express all these things that are going on in one piece of work when it's so layered and so complicated, and we don't just make work about one thing? And I think, like, it's almost like the Shebeen is like a self-portrait of Northern Ireland. It's kind of how one way we've talked about it, where it's like, yeah, almost like that is the pub is such a huge part of the culture here. You know, the stereotypes are true, essentially, you know, and it's, you know, the Irish pub is something that's, you know, through, we're known for throughout the world. And we sort of had a conversation like, can we really go there? You know, and Stephen Miller was like, we need to own that stereotype because it's ours. And, you know, it's like alcohol here is like a huge thing in a negative and a positive way. And it's how people come together and like, there's almost this feeling of everything's always on the edge here. It's either really brilliant crack and then can suddenly like flip over into the worst night you've ever had. Kind of that almost encapsulates the place in a way. There's kind of, you know, and also we talked a lot about how like the pub is where things are planned and organized and people, you know, we're a rainy culture, people meet indoors. Like that's where plans are hatched, and after the protest, that's where we would go back to again to sort of celebrate and to mourn. So it just felt like it couldn't have been anything else, I think. And it was just a really nice way of like, you know, because of the decorative style of a shebeen, it allowed all those different artworks. Like there's more than 80 artworks physically contained in it. And it's even a sort of like, not a trick that can be used with installation art, but the idea of having a familiar setting for people to walk into immediately sort of can relax you, or you know how to operate in that space. So it allows you to take in all these different things, and it's a sort of subverted version of a shebeen, but it's still a pub that everyone knows how to behave in a certain way. So yeah, I think that was some of the ideas, but
go on, Jane.
Yeah, I guess as well that that space almost inviting people into this kind of comfortable space and allow them to feel comfortable, but then being confronted with the uncomfortable and the tension. So there was something in that, like playing about with bring you in, make you comfortable, but then being forced to be uncomfortable and be existing in this immersive discomfort. So definitely something within that, which, and it kind of exactly what Sheila said there, you know, it can go from comforting to discomforting very quickly, and that's kind of a theme that really is relevant to where we're from.
Yeah, there's also a kind of universality, isn't there, to the pub. And I do love that idea that like you might go there if someone's just died and you go in grief, you know, with your friends to have a drink and toast that person, or you might go there when someone's born. You know, it's almost like the whole cycle of life can happen within a pub. Like you might meet your fiance there, you might fall in love there, you might fall out of love there. Like you can have all these experiences with your friends. And it's almost like Russ and I have always loved the bed, I think, within art in many different ways, not just obviously Tracy Emin's, but there's loads of different types of bed paintings, which I've always really loved, because of the cycle of life and so much takes place in a bed. But I think it's similar for this idea of the pub. But I particularly liked your pub because it was an illicit pub. That was the word you chose to use, I think, illicit, and sort of almost like illegal alcohol selling or something. But
that's what a shebeen is. It's an illegal.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Pub without permission.
Yeah, because it was only when Britain colonized Ireland that you suddenly had to get a license for a pub. So we held on to the shebeen, essentially.
Amazing. Well, another phrase that I've heard when listening to lots of stuff is that you guys are always punching up, which I think really kind of just encapsulates the energy of Array, is that you're always punching up, and I love that. Absolutely love that. So we are going to ask all of you the questions we ask everyone on Talk Art, but there's five of you, so we're going to have to zip through them. But we ask everyone the same questions at the end of every conversation. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, and I'll direct it to each of you individually, you could have any work of art in the world, we will help you steal it nicely. What would it be and why? Emma?
Mine would be Nan Goldin's Ballad of Sexual Dependency. The original, the slideshow with the soundtrack over the top of it. I was kind of obsessed with her when I was first studying photography, and I've seen it a few times, and it's so beautiful and powerful. And that's it.
We can get you that. Clodagh?
Ah, so hard, these questions. I was going to go really boring and be like, Mona Lisa and sell it and never have to work again. But then I was thinking, who would not dob me in? But no, then I was thinking, do you know Gillian Wearing's series of where she got people on the street to hold signs I think, what was it, signs that you want them to say, but and not what other people want them to say. But there's one, and it's a young woman, and she's holding a sign that says, "My grasp on life is rather loose." And I feel like that's a bit of me because like, it's sad. It's like happy, sad, sacky, but it's like also a good thing because wiser is she who knows she doesn't know. So it's like kind of, you don't want too tight a grasp on life because then you'll stop learning. So that's, I think I'll steal the original copy of that if it exists. I don't know.
I love that. Sheila?
I love that.
So we had a bit of a collective answer as well, but I'll maybe let Thomas say that one, or will I say it? So,
go on.
Yeah. Well, we talked about we would copy the first episode of Pose and all go into the Ulster Museum and steal all the outfits and then walk the hall within all our finery because they can make stuff nicer than some of our costumes.
You have to do that. You just have you to do, have that. To that, do is, that. That is happening.
Some
that's
of these
gathering.
Work for the museum.
Oh my gosh, we're going to start a talk art campaign to allow that to like that legally happen. But even if it looks illegal, it is kind of legal.
Listening.
That is a serious gathering and performance array style.
That is much needed.
Yeah. Thomas?
Oh, I would definitely help Sheila with that. But I think, God, it's really tough. Just to wear as a costume, I think it was a brilliant piece to see in a museum exhibition in the People's History in Manchester. They had an LGBTQ protest exhibition, and Hayley from Coronation Street Anorak was on show, and I would take that.
Iconic. And would you keep it? Would you keep it and protect it, or would you wear it?
Oh my God, I would keep it in a glass box and it'd be mine forever. Who would have to see it? God.
I think out of all the art heist we've ever had, that might be the easiest one to get.
Yeah, I think it might be.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Jane?
Mine would probably be The Weather Project by Ólafur Ellison. The huge sun that was in the turbine hall. I mean, if you know, I love anything to do with natural light and light. So, I mean, just steal the sun for me, that's all I ask, really.
That was such an amazing artwork. And it was quite a formative one for me. I remember actually sitting there when I was like 20 or something and just it really changing my idea of what art could be, which is actually a bit what you guys have also done for me now, many years later. Like I think that for me is the joy of art, isn't it? Is that it can change our perception and the way that we see the world.
Absolutely.
Good one, guys. I love this. So the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Is there a collective favourite colour?
Is there a collective favourite colour? Have you made a decision on that? Maybe? Are you going to like
a
meditate
rainbow.
And work it out?
A rainbow.
Oh.
Of course. Yeah. guys.
Yes. All your core values in one.
Absolutely.
Yes. And it really annoys people more fundamentally. In Northern Ireland, who claimed that we stole it? The gays stole the rainbow.
Really?
Yeah.
What is the best advice that Array has ever received when it comes to making your art and your practice?
I don't know if we've got any advice as a class.
I think it came from Emma, but you're doing something right if you're pissing off the right people.
That's
good advice. Good one, Emma. Wise words. What advice would you give people though, if you could give it?
I suppose I would like say, don't get bitter about how rubbish the art world is, and just keep doing it for the crack.
Yeah.
Find what you need from your peers and not the external art world. That would be my
advice. Make it for yourself.
Yeah. Trust the protest.
Yeah.
Don't let art history hang on your back like a big bag of heavy stuff. Trust what you're making. Yeah. What you can see tangibly in front of you, and it'll take you the way you should go. Cheesy.
Thanks.
I like that idea of perseverance and commitment.
Clodagh, yes. I remember you give good advice once when you were like, you know, when you get into a project, go back and look at the original idea or the original drawing to just remind yourself what you were doing it for in the first place.
Yeah, I always have this thing that if I'm like, I'll make an idea and I draw out the rough idea in my head, and then if I'm trying to make it, say if it's like a sculpture, I'm like, oh no, that line needs to be wonky like this, so try and make it exactly as wonky as I drew it, because that's how it should be. So I don't know.
Love that. Cool. You guys have been amazing. Thank you so much for coming on to Talk Art today. It has been an absolute honour chatting to you guys. And hello to the other members who weren't here tonight of Array. Thank you very much.
I know, we could do like a whole other episode. It's actually more. It's like
play the game to see if they say the same thing.
I know, wouldn't it be fascinating? That would be really interesting. And I just want to say to everyone that thank you so much for your work and thanks so much for collaborating with each other, because I think you're such a wonderful example of togetherness and solidarity and this idea of listening to one another in order to better yourself and improve the way that you are in the world, in a sense, because I think we do all have a personal responsibility to improve ourselves. And I think there's something really just inspiring about what you've all done. And even the way that you were, you know, talking about LGBT, kind of the struggle of that alongside like feminism, and how the similarities are actually stronger than the differences, in a sense, and like how we can all learn from each other. I think it's such an important thing. And yeah, and I would also say I'm not totally hating on all journalists and all critics. I think I can sometimes sound a bit strong. And there were people like Charlotte Higgins as well, who wrote a wonderful piece in The Guardian, which I loved. Yeah. And I think she's a really amazing writer. But I did also notice it was mainly women who wrote really good responses to your work, which I don't know what that says, but we need more good art critics. So, yeah, loving it. And thank you so much, all of you. And congratulations.
Thank
on
you
your
so team. Much. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you
so
much.
Can I get a screenshot? For everyone listening while we get that screenshot, please go to @talkart on Instagram, and then you guys are on Instagram. What is your handle?
@Array Studios,
and you can follow them and you will see images.
And we'll be tagging everybody on Instagram.
Absolutely.
And we'll
a lot of tags.
Yes. And thank you very much for listening. We'll be back very soon. That was a landmark moment in Talk Art history, the most guests we've ever had.
Bye!
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 You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.